You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll meet a longtime Milwaukee pastor who served a congregation in Birmingham, Alabama in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement.
First, when you see someone in a midlife crisis in a movie, they usually have some familiar elements.
Maybe someone in their 50s goes out and buys a bright red convertible, or they quit their boring desk job to follow their passion.
Our next guest says that portrayal misses the mark in a big way. For many people today, middle age means dealing with serious emotional and financial stresses.
Frank Inferna is associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He focuses on resilience in midlife and for older adults. He's the author of a piece for The Conversation titled "The Real Midlife Crisis Confronting Many Americans." Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You call the real midlife crisis today the big squeeze. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's really a combination of a lot of things. Most prominently, it's a period in which middle-aged adults are increasingly confronted with choices and emotional strain with their young adult children, but also dealing with aging parents, all while having, you know, dealing with their own health and potential financial strains as well. So it's just a combination of many factors.
Amy on Facebook shared with us she's dealing with her mom being in CBRF, community-based residential facilities, and she says, "My kid is in high school. I also have a second grader and working. It's beyond stressful, especially in the summers." That sounds like exactly the kind of stresses you're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of, one of many ways, this is happening.
And share with us some of the many ways that middle-aged adults are feeling strained by care for their aging parents.
Well, I think it's just trying to develop a plan for how it is, you know, the care may be envisioned with our aging parents. I mean, having a plan in place and kind of thinking towards, or trying to have a plan in place and thinking towards the future, because this is, I feel like, just the beginning, because given the sheer number of baby boomers who are living longer and how by 2030 there will be more people age 65 and older in the U.S. Than people who are younger than age 18.
And those parents might be in a facility, like Amy was sharing on Facebook, they might be living with their middle-aged children, or they may still be living on their own but needing a lot of support there. So it can take a lot of different forms, can't it?
Exactly. And just because, you know, your aging parent may be in a home, it doesn't mean that the stressors are gone. I mean, there are other stressors that arise. Are they getting the right and the type of care? Are their needs being met? And also the financial strain of it all. I mean, these homes are not cheap.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, because I think sometimes people don't understand what gets paid for, say, by Medicare or even supplemental insurance, and what often is still, you know, the balance at the end of all that.
Well, I mean, in the article, I open with the vignette of, you know, what my parents and their situation with my grandma in a nursing home. And before going to the nursing home, she lived at home with my parents for a year and a half. And then they decided that she needed more care than they could really give her. And for the nursing home that she went into, she needed to pay 1 year out of pocket. So she had to have $100,000 in the bank to pay. And then once her money ran out, then Medicaid kicks in and foots the bill, as well as the remaining money you may get from Social Security and so forth. So out of pocket, I mean, it's at least $400 a day for, you know, nursing home costs.
Let's switch to the other side of this midlife stress, this midlife crisis, and that is having to or wanting to help adult children longer than maybe people expected to. What's going on with adult children today that is creating this double stress?
I think it's, for one, it may be prolonged educational attainment. So kids or young adults are attending college for longer, and depending on what type of industry you're in or what type of job you're looking for, the job market may be tepid. There may be not as many opportunities. And so it's resorting to individuals having to live longer at home, which might have been unexpected.
So college might be taking longer. It's also more expensive. And also, if I'm doing my math correctly, the generation that was graduating at the end of the Great Recession is probably in their early 30s right now, somewhere around there. Have they fully recovered from coming out of college at that point?
From what I've been reading and seeing in the research, I mean, not as much as you would had hoped. I think, college, like you had mentioned, it's expensive, and your kids are having to balance, you know, paying loans, whereas could they be saving to buy a house? They're having to really balance these different options. And if the loans are too high, then how can they realistically save enough to purchase a home? And this is, of course, depends on which where you're living. You know, housing prices definitely fluctuate depending on your geographic region.
We're talking with Frank Inferno right now. He's associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He focuses on resilience in midlife and in older adults, and he's the author of a piece for The Conversation titled "The Real Midlife Crisis Confronting Many Americans." And Frank, I think it would be easy to hear this conversation and think, well, this is nothing new. There's always been a generation in the middle that has kids and that has parents. So why is this an issue now? What are some of the factors that are different now than might have been for past generations?
You're right in that, right, this is something that's been, you know, happening for a while, but I think the sheer intensity of it and the magnitude that's transpiring right now, I think, you know, given the number of baby boomers that are 65 and older and entering this stage of their life, but also I think, you know, we think the economic recession of 2008, yeah, it happened 11 years ago, but I think the ramifications are still being felt, especially within the, for young adults trying to find employment and so forth.
And you are studying this. You're doing research right now. So far, what are you finding?
I think the biggest thing that really surprises is just the number of the midlife adults that are confronting these various different issues. So it wasn't just a smaller proportion, whether it be, you know, having to deal with and kind of how are they with their aging parents, you know, young adult children who are moving back at home, maybe oftentimes not even just themselves, but bringing children home as well, and having to, you know, these increasing number of multi-generational households, I think adjusting to that emotionally, health-wise, and also financially.
And I think one of the interesting things going back to that Great Recession, which in some ways seems quite a while ago, but as you said, 11 years ago, all three of the generations that we're talking about were affected by that in different ways. And I think a lot of baby boomers, probably the parent age people, the older parent age people we're talking about, they might have ended up having to work longer because their retirement funds took a hit.
Absolutely. And I think that contributes also to, you know, young adults who may be having trouble finding employment is because you have these middle-aged adults who are having to work longer because retirement accounts were depleted and are, you know, starting to be replenished. But I think this certainly threw a wrench in people's retirement plans. If they were hoping to maybe retire, you know, in their early 60s, they are now having to delay this until their mid to late 60s.
We're talking to Frank Inferno, associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He's with us to talk about what he says is the real midlife crisis today, middle-aged adults dealing with the emotional and financial strain of supporting their aging parents and their adult children.
And we want to hear from you. Does this sound like something you're going through? Do you have older parents that you care for? Are you also still playing an active role in parenting adult children? Tell us what the experience is like by tweeting us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our discussion about the stresses felt by middle-aged people today. Frank Inferna is with us. He's an associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University, where he focuses on resilience in midlife and for older adults.
What about you? If you're middle-aged yourself, what has this period been like for you? Have you been dealing with stresses or burdens you maybe didn't expect? Or have you had a different experience? Your midlife has been more enjoyable and easier than you thought it was going to be. Tell us about your experiences by tweeting us at Central Time WPR.
And Frank, this, as we said, is an age group that you study. Does it get as much attention as some other age groups do?
Historically, midlife has been understudied when looking at the history of psychology and developmental psychology. And one of the primary reasons why is because people in midlife are leading such busy lives, so balancing many roles, whether it be work, you know, having children, shuttling them around to practice or school, and then having, you know, with dealing with aging parents. I think historically it's just been difficult to, you know, get them to participate in a research study. That's primarily been one of the main reasons why.
And I think I read that what we're talking about when we talk about midlife is basically 40 to 65. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So historically, it feels like that is the age when maybe you had kids out of the house, but you're still actively working. But now that's kind of gotten thrown off with these adult children who still need a little support much later than maybe we used to expect.
Correct, right. There's this prolonged engagement in terms of parenting.
And is part of this perhaps that we've had an idealized image of what midlife was going to be like? Is it maybe that reality is just kind of catching up with us?
I think, yeah, it's a combination of things. I think originally, you know, whenever people talked about midlife in the research literature, it'd just be like, oh, the midlife crisis. You know, people are coming to terms with, you know, they're getting older and kind of seeing what's the next stage of their life is about. But it really didn't have much substance to it. And I think what I've been most interested in is kind of shedding light on what are these different factors that are really happening to individuals in midlife. And I guess I also want to emphasize, you know, this sort of new crisis that I'm talking about, it's not a blanket thing that's happening to everyone. You know, not every middle-aged adult is dealing with these sorts of issues, but there are, it depends on one's situation, one's own life, and whether or not these sorts of things are happening to them.
And actually, I can share that Pete on Facebook wrote, I'm 52, both my parents are deceased, and my 23-year-old daughter is a debt-free college grad with a great job in her own apartment. Midlife is good. So that's the other side of the coin.
Exactly. Yeah. So this isn't happening to everyone, but it's something that in terms of the sheer number of people who are experiencing these different sorts of issues, I think is certainly increasing.
We're talking with Frank Inferna. He's associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University. And we're talking about the new midlife crisis, which is taking care of aging parents while still providing support for adult children. And let's go to the phones. And Lisa in Madison is up. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just want to say we have three generations in our family. We're taking care of my mother-in-law who's ill. And we have an adult children. One is in college, but one is disabled. And so we had to cut on our income because now my husband has to reduce his hours to take care of his mom. And we have additional expense for raising three families. And we're also sitting in our pocket. We have to take out, I could get home.
I'm sorry, Lisa, we're losing you, but we got the gist. So what Lisa said, Frank, is really interesting and something that you highlighted. Often taking care of those parents especially can mean decreased income because someone has to work less or take a less demanding job.
Exactly. I think that's especially important to emphasize that, you know, having to reduce hours at work or maybe even taking a less demanding job because you're having to take care of your loved ones at home. And when thinking about it more broadly, you know, at the federal level, we don't really have a work-family policy in place that could help out in these sorts of situations. It's more so at the state level. And that's something, there was a recent report showing that there are 6 states in the District of Columbia that have work-family policies in place for these types of situations.
Let's go back to the phone, and Bonnie in Oshkosh is up next. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm 55 years old. I have been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and Sjögren's syndrome. I am also taking care of my 79-year-old mother who has Lewy body dementia. And my boyfriend is at his end of life, so I'm taking care of him as well. I'm working a full-time job.
And it sounds like that's a lot that you're dealing with. How has that affected you, Bonnie?
Well, I have had to put my health on back burner to make sure everybody else is okay, and I'm paying for it now.
Thank you so much for that, Bonnie, and I'm sorry that you're dealing with so much. Frank, that's another aspect we haven't touched on yet, the health of the people who are actually doing the caregiving and giving support to others.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like Bonnie said, I mean, she's having to put her own health needs on the back burner to ensure she's able to take care of her mother and her boyfriend.
Let's go back to the phones, and Sharon in Madison's up. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What would you like to share?
Good. Well, I just wanted to confirm kind of what Frank has said about hard situations. In our family, we've had some major transition. My mother, who is 95, moved out of her home that we've all lived in and grew up in for 63 years. She's been in that home, and it was a hard knock for her to realize that she was not going to be able to live out at the end of her days in this home. And then I myself, on top of that, just retired in April. And made a major move of my own to Madison, and it's sort of been one not normal thing after another. And I mean, to the point where the last caller said something about putting her own health on hold, and I just today acknowledged that I really needed to talk to somebody about this. So I actually sought out a counselor and went and had a conversation today for the first time in my life ever. I'm 66. And she just was kind and said, you're going through a whole bunch of losses and transition. And she said, even though it's not a death, all of these things that you're going through are still fodder for grief. And she said, you have to let yourself go through that.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon, and I'm glad you're getting some help and support for yourself. Good luck with all of that. And Frank, every kind of change we go through throughout life is a stressor, and it sounds like what you're finding is that, just like Sharon was sharing, you know, it's stress upon stress upon stress.
Absolutely, yeah. It almost, there's a accumulation or avalanche effect where one thing piles on top of one another to kind of brings people to this breaking point of, you know, how much can someone handle before, you know, their health significantly declines, or, you know, acknowledging and knowing that, okay, I need support and I need help. And what are ways that I can kind of seek this out?
We just heard from 3 women callers in a row, Frank. Do men and women experience midlife and the burdens that come with it differently?
Absolutely. You raise a really good point. Typically, women are disproportionately affected by these changes. They're more likely to be taking on these caregiving roles when it comes to having to take care of their aging parents.
Frank, you've spent some time abroad in Germany. Are there things we can learn from other countries about how to make midlife easier?
Yes, I do. So before coming to Arizona State, I lived in Berlin, Germany for 2 years, and seeing the various policies that they have in place there. So one thing that sticks out prominently for me is when you have a child, you know, the each spouse, if they both take time off, they can share 14 months of paid time off at about 70% of their wages to, you know, adjust to having a child and get into a new routine and really in the early developmental stages of your child's life. And I was just there a couple of weeks ago and talking with my friends and colleagues there. They said, in terms of when having to take care of a loved one or an aging parent, there are similar types of policies in place. Not the amount of time off is not as extensive, but it's very similar setup as if you were having a child.
You mentioned earlier, Frank, that there are not federal policies currently that really support people with the stresses of midlife. They tend to be more state policies. Would having more consistent policies across states be useful?
I think it would definitely be useful. You know, and depending on the state, it could be up to currently the policies. It could be up to 12 weeks of paid time at about ranging from 50% to 80% of one's wages. And just having that sort of time to kind of adjust to a new living situation of if your aging parent is coming to live with you or if you're having to move them from elsewhere, if they're living in a different city. I think those sorts of policies and paid time off could really help relieve some of the burdens, not all of them, but would certainly help people adjust.
And we'll have to leave it there. That was Frank Inferna, an assistant professor of psychology at Arizona State University. He focuses on resilience in midlife and for older adults, and he joined us today to talk about the financial and emotional stress some people in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s are feeling today.
Coming up after the news, we'll meet a longtime Milwaukee pastor who served a congregation in Birmingham, Alabama in the middle of the civil rights movement and at one of its most emotional and galvanizing points. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former Badger band director Mike Leckrone is teaching a continuing education course about the big band era. We'll talk about some of the music and performers who shaped that period.
Now, one of the most tragic and shocking moments in the American Civil Rights Movement happened in September of 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama.
A KKK bomb attack at an African-American church killed four girls, Addie Mae Collins, age 14, Carol Denise McNair, age 11, Carol Robertson, age 14, and Cynthia Wesley, age 14.
The bombing was the latest in a string of bomb attacks targeting African-Americans in that heavily segregated city. Our next guest was there in Birmingham at the time as a white pastor of an African-American Lutheran congregation.
He served in that community and then in Milwaukee at Cross Lutheran, and he's devoted his life and work to reaching across lines of race, of religion, of economic status, and of citizenship.
Joseph W. Ellwanger is a retired Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor. He's the author of the book Strength for the Struggle. Reverend Ellwanger, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Throughout your work and throughout your book, you're motivated by a concept called accompaniment ministry. You don't talk about doing work for people, but with them and walking alongside them. Why has that been such a guiding principle for you?
Well, that's the very opposite of the segregationist system and even, you know, some of the more white moderates in the South who would say that they were friendly and were not prejudiced against African Americans, but in fact they were very paternalistic, and they were really looking down upon African Americans, even as they said that they had nothing in the way of a racist attitude. And so, accompaniment ministry means that you walk alongside of people, accepting people as equals. as people who have something to give to you, as surely as you have something to give to them. And so it's all the difference in the world. And, you know, white folks may not recognize the difference in terms of relationships with blacks and whites, but blacks are very quick to pick up whether a white person is being paternalistic and looking down rather than accompanying them as equals.
And another theme you come back to again and again is the importance of reaching across religious lines to other Christian denominations and to other faiths, even in your career when that got you into trouble.
Yeah, yes, that's true. I belonged at the time to a segment of the Lutheran Church in the United States that was very rigid in saying that, you know, we were not supposed to be worshiping with people of another denomination. And this just didn't ring true. And I had my knuckles wrapped a couple of times because I did participate across denominational lines. And strangely enough, ironically enough, it was in the funeral service for three of the four girls killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, where I was asked by the father of one of those four girls, who happened to be a member of my congregation. He asked me and his wife, who is a member of 16th Street Baptist Church, they asked me to participate in the funeral service, and I had my bishop, in effect, that was not his title, at the time, but in effect, he called me and asked me not to participate because that would be crossing denominational lines. And that was one of the points where I made it very clear to myself and to my bishop that I saw the gospel calling me to relate to anyone at any level and within the Christian church, certainly, to be willing to walk with them and to worship with them. So I did participate in that service for three of the four girls.
Talking to Reverend Joseph L. Langer of Milwaukee, his book is called Strength for the Struggle, Insights from the Civil Rights Movement and Urban Ministry. Take us back to that day in 1963, September 15th, when KKK bombers blew up that Baptist church and murdered four girls. You were there in Birmingham, and as you were just saying, in the aftermath, talk about what you saw and heard and felt there.
Well, I remember that very vividly to this day. It's one of those events that you don't forget. I was teaching an adult Bible class at the congregation that I pastored, which was about 16 blocks away from the 16th Street Baptist Church. But in the middle of our Bible class, we heard a loud boom, and it was so loud that everybody stopped in the middle of whatever we were talking about, and we were silent and for about 5 or 6 seconds, and then one of the women in the class said, "I hope that was not what I think it may have been, another bombing in Birmingham." So, you know, as African Americans in Birmingham at the time, where some 35 bombings had taken place of homes, of movement leaders, and people that the KKK thought were moving too fast, were so common that's what this woman thought of that morning when they heard the a blast. And sure enough, about 8-9 minutes later, a young man came running into the church and looking for Chris McNair, who was the member of our congregation and Sunday school superintendent and the father of one of the four girls who was killed. And so that's when we learned that it was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And it was an event that put the whole city of Birmingham on edge, you know, very tense. In the white community, it was a very large segment of the white community that saw the bombing as a kind of comeuppance to the black community for conducting the demonstrations that had gone on in the spring of 1963. This bombing was a retaliation against those demonstrations because the KKK saw that, and many, many white moderates, Southerners, saw that those demonstrations as moving too fast, too far, even if the elimination of segregation was something good, which they didn't believe. But if even if it were, they said that this was not the way to do it, not the way to go about it. So this was the attitude of many whites in Birmingham at the time was, well, this was what they deserved, the black community deserved. Others recognized that, you know, bombing a church, any church on a Sunday morning was really a horrible thing to do. And so their attitude, whites who would not go so far as to say that they deserved it, would have said, well, they didn't deserve it. It's a terrible event, but they should have expected it. You can't push the envelope as far as the demonstrations did in the spring of 63 in March and ask for the elimination of segregation and think you're going to not have any repercussions. In the black community, of course, it was basically a sense of, first of all, grief for the families with the four children. There was a lot of anger, obviously. But just a few people who really wanted to retaliate violence for violence. Basically, the black community was saying, this is a horrible deed. But let's not pull ourselves down to the level of the KKK. And so in the middle of all of that tension, to participate in that funeral service was an unforgettable experience where the church was packed and 2,000 or 3,000 in the street who couldn't get in for the funeral. And the moans and the cries during the service, you know, Lord have mercy and why, God, why? It was that kind of a tense moment in Birmingham.
Reverend Joseph Ellwanger of Milwaukee is with us. He's a retired pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, serving in Birmingham, Alabama in the Civil Rights era, and in Milwaukee at Cross Lutheran for over three decades. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reverend Joseph Ellwanger about his career as a pastor in Birmingham, Alabama in the Civil Rights era, and then in Milwaukee, serving mostly African-American congregations in both cities. Reverend Ellwanger, I was born in 1970, so 7 years after the bombing we were just talking about, 2 years after the death of Martin Luther King Jr., and I think the way I was taught about civil rights history is that it was history. Things were bad. The civil rights movement happened. We're basically good now. And I think that's a pretty common attitude. What would you say to people who hold that attitude?
Well, that is a mixed bag, to be sure. Certainly, we have made some progress. And in the South, you can go South today with a mixed, racially mixed group and go into a restaurant and be served. And that is totally different from the way it was in the 1960s. And, of course, it's very important to recognize that what brought that change about was the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that the demonstrations in Selma were all about. And once the African Americans in the South actually got the vote and could even run for office, things changed. Even white folks recognized that, and white elected leaders realized they had to get some of the black vote or they wouldn't be elected. So suddenly things did change, and we can be grateful for the dismantling of the de jure segregation, especially of public places in the South. But the reality is that there's been a lot of pushback since then, even in the North and throughout the country, pushback against, for instance, the Voting Rights Act, which made such a change in the South. And we have, I believe, that the voter ID laws and other practices in various states throughout the country are a pushback to make it difficult for people, and especially people of color, but it spills over and makes it difficult for others to vote as well, especially older people and students. But that's a reminder to us that maybe the discrimination is not as overt today as it was in the 1960s. So that's changed, but there's a lot of racism simmering underneath the surface that pops up constantly here and there, and especially in the recent elections and in some of the violence that the far right has used to try to push things back. So the justice challenge today is somewhat different, but it's very real.
In 1967, you moved north from Alabama to join us here in Wisconsin at Cross Lutheran in Milwaukee. What led you here?
People ask me that question. Believe me, when I left Birmingham, Alabama in 1967, there was a huge lump in my throat. I really loved the people, the congregation, and the challenge of the South, and I saw the changes beginning to take place, and I really had a tough time with the call to Cross Church. But in the Lutheran tradition, when a pastor is called by one congregation, the pastor has pretty much the decision to make. Is this God's call for me to leave this congregation now and go to this other, or do I stay? And so I was the one who had to really wrestle with this call. And the reason why I did finally decide to leave what was truly my love in Birmingham was the terms of the call that I got from Cross Church were that they wanted me to come to help them to reach out to the community, which when the congregation had been formed some 75 years before, it was all white and German and Jewish mainly. But now, 1967, African Americans had moved into the neighborhood to the point that the neighborhood was now 90% black. And the congregation said, we want you to come and help us reach into the community, and we will walk with you in doing that. And so I thought, well, in 1967, we want this country to change. We want an integrated society, not a segregated society. And if any institution ought to be leading the way, I said to Cross Church and to myself, it ought to be the church. And so I came to see whether indeed we could lead Cross Church to become a racially integrated church or congregation. They had just begun to accept a handful of African-American members. And so that was a good sign that they were serious about it. And so I came.
Talking to Reverend Joseph Ellwanger, his book is called Strength for the Struggle. One very concrete change, I love you, in a chapter of your book, you quote Psalms, sing to the Lord a new song. You had a very practical decision to make about whether there would be new songs sung at Cross Church.
I do remember the day that Gloria Wright came to me. She had been a member of CROSS, then moved out to the suburbs. And when I came, she was they were had just moved back into the community, and so she was thinking of coming back to the congregation. But she asked me whether she could form a youth choir at CROSS Church, and I thought, well, any pastor who would refuse an offer like that must have rocks in his head. So I said, oh, I'd be happy to have you form a youth choir. And she said, well, I have another question. And she said, can we sing any song that we want to sing? And I said, well, any song that that's all about the gospel and is furthering that word of forgiveness and reconciliation and all that goes with the gospel would be fine. So the youth choir was formed, and they, of course, began singing a variety of songs. And the congregation said, well, why can't we sing them? And I said, why not? So we developed an urban hymnal supplement. And what would you believe that the CROSS Youth Choir will be celebrating its 50th anniversary. It became a choir that really made a difference in our congregation, in the community, and in the Lutheran Church. So that was a more awesome beginning than I realized at the moment. But we definitely changed songs, and some people could enjoy that and some couldn't. So we lost a few members over that, but we won a whole lot more.
Throughout your book, you highlight people who've inspired you throughout your work. Who do you look at, Reverend Ellwanger, who inspires you today?
My, oh my, there are many. And in my book, I raise up a lot of what most people would consider, quote, ordinary people. Because when you accompany people, it means that you really are open to their gifts. And so there are people who have enriched me beyond their own recognition and awareness. So I don't want to minimize or overlook those regular people who've had a real influence on me. And Gloria Wright, who came asking to form a youth choir, is a good example of someone who had the leadership skills and really did a great job and enriched me as we learned a lot of new songs. But if you look on a little higher level, certainly I would have to say that to this very day, Dr. King has an influence on me because he was an amazingly bold prophet is what I would have to call him. The country sort of looks at him as a great orator and someone who definitely led the way in some changes in the South. But he showed really showed the church, and this goes across denominational lines, showed the church and the faith community, which goes across faith lines, that any living of the religious life has to have a connection with working on the injustices of the society, or else it's not authentic. And so it was Dr. King that showed me and showed hundreds and thousands of pastors and lay people that the gospel is all about working on justice for the whole community, and not just for bringing people into the church.
Reverend Ellwanger, thank you so much for joining us. Reverend Joseph Ellwanger is a retired Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor. He's served congregations in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Milwaukee. He's the author of Strength for the Struggle. There are a lot of fun ways to decorate a Christmas tree, old family ornaments or stylish monochromatic ones, garland or tinsel, a lot of options.
I'd say that most have some kind of lighting as part of the decorations, but I don't think anyone can top what the Tennessee Aquarium in Chattanooga has. They hooked up their Christmas tree to their electric eel. And that eel's name, Rab, are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Miguel Watson.
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 I get it. Even I get that. So visitors to the museum can see Miguel and then see the lights of the tree outside his tank flashing as he emits those electrical currents that electric eels do. It's pretty cool. There's video online, and it doesn't hurt Miguel to do this.
No, not at all. And no surprise, Miguel is quite the celebrity, and like all media-savvy public figures, he tweets. You can follow him at Electric Miguel. He actually has a great sense of humor.
And that's E-E-L-E-C-T-R-I-C, so Electric. You get it?
You know what?
Full of puns, these eels.
You know what, Rob? I just thought of something. What if we hooked him up to one of those Wisconsin aluminum trees?
Ooh, yeah. Those would really conduct, though. I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
Try
I like
that.
It.
How about this? Try it in your living room. And you could set up the eel tank there,
okay.
too.
Okay, and the live feed, of course.
Eel news you can use. This is Central Time.